One of the most common things I hear from parents is something along the lines of, "Oh, just wait until he turns two. You'll never rest again. They are monsters." Or, "Just wait until she's a teenager. Then you'll see how hard your mom had it with you." I never really integrated those phrases. It just sounded like people who were frustrated and hadn't quite figured it out yet. From my own personal childhood experience, where children seem to be a type of burden on a parent's freedom or happiness, I learned pretty early on what I would and what I wouldn't say to my future children. And if I ever wanted to have a relationship with them, I needed to be very clear on that. When I became pregnant, I decided I was going to choose the path of least resistance. I decided I was going to enjoy my pregnancy. I decided I was going to birth the way I wanted to, come hell or high water. And I was going to learn to be in power with my baby, not have power over my baby. A decade later, today, I'd like to think I've done pretty okay. And how do I know that? Well, my daughter's curiosity has not been extinguished. I see she can clearly hold her boundaries with anyone, including me. By no means can she be manipulated. And she still considers spending time with me as something fun and safe for her. I'll likely record an episode on how I think I might have accomplished this, so stay tuned. As a doula, birth educator, lactation counselor, and woman, I know that parents, especially women, because that's who I primarily talk to, really want what is best for their baby, for their children. They want to do it right. They want it to feel good for everyone. Today, I'm chatting with Dr. Tom Cowan, who wrote the paradigm-shifting books, The Contagion Myth, Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness, as well as the household favorite, The Nourishing Traditions Book of Baby and Child Care, who he co-authored with Sally Fallon. We dive deep into his most recent book, Common Sense Child Rearing, which I truly didn't put down and finished in one day. It perfectly encapsulates the unlearning we must do as adults to fully unlock the potential for the beautiful, healthy, and harmonious relationship we can have with our children. I was moved by the nuanced yet profound steps he shares to become a more embodied and connected human and parent. It made me excited to be a mom again. It also gave me the exhale we all need as parents when we feel like we may have really effed things up. And that can happen when we start taking accountability for the person we were when we didn't know any better. And of course, we talk about some of the highly charged beliefs we hold around reward and punishment, and something I often find myself debating with people. Do babies really remember all of the things done to them at birth and in their first years? You'll hear it straight from the mouth of a medical doctor who quite literally has seen it all. As always, thanks for being part of the Born to Know family. Tom, thank you so much for joining me today. I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time.
Thanks for having me. It's good to talk to you.
I've been following your work for a couple of years now. I first discovered it when I was on my own parenting journey with my daughter and looking for alternatives. I know that you've become really well known in various circles when it comes to the truth about parenting, the truth about approaching pediatrics, alternative health. A more like holistic approach to how to be a connected parent, and how to form, I guess, like this autonomy in the parenting and health journey when it comes to our children. I like to use the phrase decentralized parenting, decentralized health, because what I experienced as I was going through your work in my earlier years of motherhood was that I was unlearning a lot. And I knew that I was going to be going through a relearning process, but it was the unlearning that was incredibly challenging for me at times, but it was also what was very exciting. So it was like this incredible dance that I had fallen into. And you know, just simple things like, I remember cloth diapering, right? Like I was really, you know, invested in cloth diapering. Let's just use that as an example. And it was the easiest thing for me. And everyone had told me it's going to be really challenging. Everyone had told me, you know, parenting is hard. Those first few months are hard. And following the principles of what I unlearned, right? I had to unlearn that it was hard and I had to surrender to whatever was communicated to me by my baby. It actually was maybe the easiest time that I experienced in my motherhood journey.
I think when you, quote, do it right, it becomes a lot easier. I can give examples of that. But doing it, quote, wrong, not that there's a wrong or a right way, but it's tough. And your life can be hell. And I've seen that. I've experienced it. And I heard that over and over and over. My life with my child is hell. And it was very simple. The reason why, it's because they were creating this hell that was inevitable. And I can give examples of what I mean by that if you want. But
well, yeah, I would, of course, would love to hear those examples, because what I noticed in this journey was that so much of what I unlearned was what I would say is like clinical logic, legal logic, sociocultural logic about what mothering was supposed to be and what my child's status of health was supposed to be. And when I guess went more into woman's logic and maybe more spiritual logic about the process, there wasn't anything that I was pushing up against anymore. And so, yeah, I would love to hear some examples of, you know, why women or parents in general, like we have this cultural logic about it being so, I mean, cultural meaning Western. I mean, let's say Western logic about why it's supposed to be so painful, difficult.
I mean, I think if I was to say that the root cause or the foundational thought that undermines and parents and makes it very difficult. And by the way, I did not like come into the world knowing or thinking like this. And I have often said if they gave a worst parent of the year award, I would have been up for the running a number of times because I had no clue. And I have three children and one stepson. And it was only they were eventually got through to me on like what was going wrong that I sort of figured some things out. But let's give an example, because, you know, as a doctor, I heard, and I used to, you know, of course, told people to eat good food, and they would bring their children to me, and they children were had health problems, and I would say, you have to have the child eat good food, obviously, and they couldn't. They couldn't get the child to eat good food. And I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of families I saw that were being like wrecked with what I would call food fights. Every meal is just a battle, and you got to eat it. And if you don't eat it, you can't go out and you got to eat this or you can't get dessert and on and on and on. And the interesting thing for me, I had lived in Swaziland as a Peace Corps volunteer for 2 years, and I lived with a family and they had little children in all the different ages. And I never once saw any child not eat their food. It did happen once, I remember, a child said something about their food. I didn't know what they said. And one of the child's brothers took away the food and ate it, like right away. And that was the last time anybody complained about their food. And what struck me, and it's obvious actually, is that children do not fight about the food. They fight about autonomy, or you could say the right to choose what to eat. Now, I would fight about that too, because that's how I choose food. I choose food based on what I want to eat and what I think is good for me and what works the best. And I don't eat food that I don't like. And I don't eat food that I think is going to not be good for me. And so I reserve the right to choose what I want to eat, as I think any human being, even a small child, does. Now, because that's a, quote, good thing to have food autonomy, I decided to give it to them. I let the child eat whatever they want to eat. Now, what I realized had happened, because people are like, are you kidding? You know, what if they eat, like, you know, candy and Twinkies all day? So what I realized is that if you give, that the, all the food fights are about autonomy or the right to choose. So if you recognize that and give them that right, they will give you the right to choose what to feed them, because they don't really care about that. And I remember I figured this out when my youngest was 10, Joe, and I had enough of trying to make him eat vegetables or whatever. And I said, "You, Joe, you just eat whatever you want." He said, "Aren't you going to make me eat my broccoli?" And I said, "How would I do that?" And he said, "Well, you could try to stuff it down my throat." I said, "Like with a stick or like a toilet plunger? I mean, how am I going to do that?" And he laughed. He said, "Well, you could say that I can't go out and play on the trampoline if I don't eat my broccoli, right?" And I said, "Well, I don't care. If you want to go out and play on your trampoline, it's probably fine." And okay, so then I didn't give him anything else to eat, because he has the right to choose whether to eat it. And just like the Swazi family, I have the right to choose what to give him. So I gave him whatever. He didn't eat it. And then the next day, you know, he went outside and played and was happy and there was no fight. And the next day he ate it. And then every once in a while he would say, "You know, I like Brussels sprouts better than broccoli." So I gave him Brussels sprouts. And that was the end of the food fights. Because, you know, and the worst thing that happened, and I've done this with hundreds of patients, and it is 100% successful. And the worst thing that can happen is they go to bed hungry one night. And as long as, you know, the key, and I've also noticed this with my cats, if I'm emotionally invested in, like, Lucy eating her food because she's the one who lives outside and it's cold and I worry about her, and if she doesn't eat her warm food, I think she's going to freeze to death. And as soon as I think, "You have to eat this," she doesn't eat, because I'm infringing on her autonomy. I'm infringing on her freedom. So she does what's appropriate, which is say, "No, you have to learn to grow up and respect other people or my freedom, or I'm going to starve myself."
She feels the pressure in the quantum.
She feels the pressure. And she needs to teach me how to be a better person. And she's willing to suffer a little bit in order to help me learn to be a better person. And that's amazing, really, because she's willing to go hungry if I'm not willing to just say, "I made the food. Lucy, you can eat it or not." As soon as I do that, she eats her food. Because she likes to eat. Children like to eat, and they don't care if it's broccoli or whatever. You know, you can work with them to figure out what they like and what's good for you. And if they say, "No, I have to eat Doritos," you say, "Fine, go to the store, get your own money, you know, go get a job and get your money and get Doritos."
Yeah, that's what we do in our house. If there are requests for things that are outside of what I'm offering, then she's more than welcome to, at 9 years old, to take her hard-earned money and get what she needs or what she says she wants, you know. And very often if she makes a request, like, she, you know, it never pierced her ears. I never did anything to her that she didn't consent to, like antibiotics, you know, vaccinations, a haircut, piercing her ears, nothing. And so at 9, she said, I'd like to get my ears pierced. I said, okay, let's talk about it in a month. Because the policy is if in a month it's still she still feels excited about the thing, then we'll do the thing. And so, yeah, you know, she said, okay, I'm ready. And it was a whole ceremony and it really mattered to her. And now it's like, it's for her, it was a rite of passage of, you know, coming in close to her double digits, she said. So, because I always talked to her about how we don't have rites of passage, you know, in our culture, really. I mean, like we have bat mitzvahs, you know, we have quinceañeras, we have different things in the West that we could say are rites of passage. But other than that, I mean, there isn't really, apart from, you know, when a girl begins to menstruate, I'm hard pressed to find these really ceremonial rites of passage that can help a girl or a boy really denote themselves now into manhood, womanhood. Like I see in other cultures with, you know, face tattoos or, you know, month long preparations from all the women in the community to help them, you know, guide them into womanhood or their childbearing years. And so she's always saying, let's do this as a rite of passage. And so we're always having that conversation. In all your work with children, did you, like, how valuable is that rite of passage, would you say? Because what I'm noticing a lot working in the birth world and having clients who, you know, I've known them now, some of the babies I watched be born, you know, 14 years ago are now in their teens. And I'm noticing that the mothers are saying, like, I'm not really sure how to initiate my son or initiate my daughter, you know. And I always suggest things like, you know, how about some controlled hardship, like tasks around the home, work, you know, because, and I want to get to this, your what you wrote about in your book, you know, this whole idea of school. And so they're going through this, you know, very centralized type of what we think is education, but it's really schooling. And then the children don't have actual opportunities to learn discernment or learn how to initiate into their own, I don't know, into embody really. And so they look for things for their kids to do to give them responsibility, give them some controlled hardship, but it's difficult for them. So as a doctor, as a, you know, family practitioner, like how would you say, and as a parent, like how would you say we can create these initiations for children? Is it that simple or is it a much bigger can of worms?
Yeah, I can't say that I've looked into the sort of traditional rites of passage or initiation processes very much. My experience is, like, and this is my looking back on my life, that life will give you the experiences that you need in order to sort of overcome challenges. Like I wrote a chapter in the book on my encounters with a fellow named Willie in my high school. And it, basically, you know, I was the only white guy on the all otherwise black basketball team. And it was pretty challenging. And I got like threatened and punched and, you know, physically intimidated. But I had this connection with the best player on the team who also knew that he kind of needed me to so that the team would be as good as it could be and he would get noticed and eventually go to college and have be a basketball player. So, you know, and that's why I'm you know, it's one thing to keep your children safe. Like, I don't think you should let a three-year-old run out in the street and get hit by a car. So your first job is keep them safe. But your job is not to shield them from what life will throw at them. And life will present you with challenges. And, you know, I talk a lot in the book about being on your child's side and what that means and how do you do that. And if a child knows that their parents are on their side, it's a game changer. Now, I didn't know that because my parents, I never even talked about what was happening with my parents. So I just went through it by myself and sort of figured it out. But it had a big impact on my life. And I think when you, if you could be on your child's side, in other words, you're just hearing what their experience is. You're not even trying to necessarily coach them or guide them unless they ask you, like, what would you do in this situation? Then you might say, here's what I might do. Otherwise, you just are there just to listen and hear their story, and they'll figure it out. And your job is not to, like a lot of times happens today, to try to have nothing bad happen to your child. Like, that's sort of the model for today's parents. And that's a recipe for a weak child.
I guess some might call it a helicopter mom, for example. I was creating this somatic experiencing course with a friend who's a somatic experiencing coach, and I was creating it for my clients who are, you know, planning for birth. And the whole premise is just noticing the system and when it becomes dysregulated, what, you know, how to just identify that as a first step. And one of the examples he uses in the class is that when you take a child to a playground, for example, they did this experiment, I think it was in Netherlands actually, where they took children to playgrounds, and one of the playgrounds had this fence, this wooden fence that was at the perimeter. And so the mother said to the children, you can go anywhere within the wooden fence, right? And so the children felt that kind of container where I said, I'm free to do whatever I need within these parameters, and like, everything's fair game. The mother's systems were able to relax and kind of settle into that experience. And the children's systems were also able to settle into that experience because there was a framework presented. And whatever happened within that framework happened, right? They fell off the swing, or they went down the slide head first and hit their head. However, what they noticed is that children weren't fighting with each other, and children didn't, like, you know, come out screaming and feeling like they needed their mother. The other part of that experiment was taking them to a playground where there was no wooden perimeter, and there was a street nearby that had, you know, some cars. The mother's systems couldn't relax, and they kept telling the children, stay close, don't go. Stay close, don't go. Can't go beyond this point, or you can't go beyond that point. And it seemed really arbitrary which point that they could go past. It was all based on the mother's ability to hold discomfort, you know, the distance, right?
That's similar to another chapter in the book where I learned a lot from this place called Noken, which I think is in Holland. And so they have a perimeter, and it's like a homestead with a farm, and they have no rules for the children, except the children, you are not to help a child climb the tree. So they come to, in the morning, and they sing a song, and a child can sing with them if they want. Then they go outside, and the adults make bread and tend the garden and feed the chickens, and the children can help or not. They can go off and play or climb trees. And they have this huge tree, and there's sometimes like 20 children in various branches of the tree. And the young children often can't climb the tree because it's too hard to get up. And they never help them. You just don't. And, you know, even if a child, which they don't in this situation, would say, oh, you know, cry, you know, I want to go up in the tree. First of all, if they can't climb the tree, it's not safe for them to be up in the tree. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, you take away the beauty and the meaning of life by helping them climb a tree. And even if it takes them a year, they circle the tree and touch the tree and kick the tree and they're angry with the tree and whatever, it's just fine. And then one day they're strong enough and savvy enough and they climb the tree and everybody's happy. And that's how you do it. And I've had experiences with my grandchildren. And one of them in particular was climbing this thing and spent a whole day trying to climb this thing. And it was hard for her. And then I as I say, stupidly helped her bottom, you know, by and helped her to get up to the next level. At that point, she lost interest in the climbing thing and started saying to me, I'm bored. What should I do? What should I do? And I think she was punishing me for being an idiot because I interfered with, I mean, so what if she's frustrated? It's fine. I mean, she was, and if she can't get up, she can't get up. But it turns out she could, you know, eventually could. And she didn't need me to help. And I took away the meaning of that experience from her by helping her up that climbing thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's so fascinating to note that a parent's discomfort with their child's frustration is really why they go in to correct them. I don't really believe that it's so much that they want to prevent the child from feeling frustrated. They just don't have the capacity yet to witness someone else's frustration, you know? And like, I remember with my daughter, I just turned the whole, I lived in this like tiny Miami apartment. She was born in that apartment. And I just basically made the whole thing her playpen, let's say the whole floor. I never had like a little cage for her or anything like that. So she was able to go wherever she wanted to. And if she could climb it, she could. And if she fell, she would fall and then she wouldn't do it again until. So that's why I suspect she started walking right before 11 months. I never used a stroller or anything like that. And we had these back steps that went to the garden. And one time she got out and I just watched from the window and she kind of like rolled down the back steps and like hit her head on the concrete and then like sat up and was like, what just happened? Oh my gosh, I'm outside and like grass. And like, I broke free from the apartment and she's just out there, you know? And like you said in your book, it's like, unless some severe danger is about to go down, like, do not intervene. And so it felt instinctual to me, you know, because I knew the whole area was safe. And again, it's the idea of that wooden fence. It's like, if I create this whole area of safety, everything within there is just for her to explore, to examine, and to start learning discernment and say, oh, I like going into this room. I'll go there now. And I'm not telling her to go to the room or to go play in that room, right? That's why I never had like a designated playroom, because for her, the underneath the kitchen sink where we had all these like pots and pans, that was like her play area. You know, that's what she found the most interesting for whatever she was working out at the time.
Right. And I'm not saying you let a three-year-old run in the street and get hit by a car. That's like, right, of course. But, you know, within the parameters of you create, you know, our job as adults, so-called, and parents is to create as many possibilities for them to do what they need to do. And then you interact. It's like at this place, some children will ask you how to make bread. And then you just make bread with them. You don't even teach them how to make bread. You just make bread or plant carrots or feed chickens or climb trees or throw a softball or play a recorder or whatever it is. And when you do that, the children respond in a completely different way than what we see today's children.
Right. That's something I really appreciated about the time we spent at the Waldorf School before we started homeschooling. I loved that there was a whole interview process, first of all, about my birth, how long I breastfed, the whole thing. However, they said to me, we have to make sure that what we're doing here, you're doing at home. Like, it has to be absolutely consistent because children learn through osmosis. They're just experiencing you doing, and that's how they learn to do. That was really a really important thing for me to internalize. And, you know, since then, I've never, never had an expectation, thankfully, that she's going to be doing something that I wouldn't otherwise do, right? Like, how can I expect her to learn this thing in this like isolated bubble if I'm not participating in the thing, you know? And so it removed a lot of pressure of feeling like, oh, she has to go do that, or she has to like just the, I was just all about removing pressure from my journey because I'd been working with so many women who were excited about their birth, but dreaded, actually, maybe not consciously, the mothering part. How does this work? What am I going to do? Everyone has horror stories. Everyone's life gets hijacked by this child. Like, there's a lot of resistance around that integration, I noticed. And so I said, how am I going to just make this like an amazing addition to my life? And so, you know, co-sleeping, baby wearing, you know, I had like maybe 4 items for the child, including the diapers. And I said, this is going to be the addition, and it's just going to be as easy as possible. And how can I do that? And that's kind of what was guiding me, even when she was quote unquote unwell, right? Like, I remember one morning, it's like 3 a.m. and she woke up like projectile vomiting. It was like the first time she'd had any kind of issue. And I was like, oh, okay. And I just like held her and she vomited. It was all breast milk. And I just remember thinking like, well, you know, it's just one night. I don't, you know, I'm not worried. Like, maybe she ate something. She crawls everywhere. Maybe she ate a worm or something. It's Florida and there's plants everywhere. You know, like, I don't know what this could be. And I know that most clients of mine would have been, you know, calling urgent care, or they would have gone to the ER. I mean, it was like exorcist style, like on the walls. And I just had to trust something inside of me that said, like, she's passing something, you know? And that was a rite of passage for me, to trust my internal system saying, it's okay, it's going to pass. Rather than what I had been, you know, maybe taught as a child, you know, to react to these things and go to a centralized medical system to give me information about what was going on. And that really set the tone, I would say. And even today, I know we're talking earlier, I said she's having a morsel conflict because she, for the second time in her life at 9 years old, was vomiting like everywhere. And so, and she was just like looking at me, and she'd turn over and she'd vomit and she'd say, oh, this doesn't feel great. She's like, sometimes I feel like I'm in a video game. And I was just thinking like back to that moment when she was 2, and I was like, yeah, if I had reacted differently, perhaps at that moment when she was 2, if my system had gone haywire and I'd picked her up and panicked and, you know, made her feel scared of her own body, she might not be so calm today, you know? And that leads me to a different question about, like, you know, a lot of people say to me, because I've gone through the whole like circumcision conversation or certain childhood procedure conversation with my clients, and they'll always say, you know, children don't remember. Like, we want to do it to them as early as possible because they'll have no memory of it later. And then when I've done these birth trauma processing sessions with adults, which is something that I do quite often, I've had men actually recall the moment of their circumcision. Like, they'd never thought about it before, but through the meditative process, they've actually recalled maybe seeing their dad on the other side of the glass, or just these snippets of memory come through. What would you say? Like, do you believe that children remember, right? Because if the body remembers, then we remember on some level.
Everybody remembers everything, period. And by the way, having seen a circumcision and I was supposedly being taught how to do them, I saw one. It was that is the definition of torturing a baby. If you've ever seen somebody being circumcised, you would never circumcise your child. Never. And, you know, in my residency, I was there's a whole thing. And when you do this, you always want to do it to be certified to do as many procedures as possible, because that's how you make money. So I had the possibility of being certified to do circumcisions. And I saw one, and I already knew, but they made me see one, made me sort of. And I said, I'm never going to another one. I don't care what you guys say. I'm never doing this. And what do you mean? You don't want to do this? You know, there is no way I'm ever going to participate in this. So it is barbaric. I mean, torture, and of course they remember everything. Everybody remembers everything that ever happened to them. It's embedded in the structure of your being. Anybody who says that that's not true is, I mean, that's just ignorant. But You know, I was going to say, there's when you get into this stuff, as far as I can see, there's two reasons why parents don't sort of, you know, like they when they hear this, they probably think, yeah, this makes sense. But there's two things that happen to parents that get them. One is this idea that if they don't teach their children properly, the child is going to grow up and be like a savage, like a out of control, drug addicted, homeless bum, prostitute, you know, whatever. Like nothing good will happen unless I show them the proper way. And that's just total nonsense. And the other thing that happens is, I would be sitting with somebody, bring their child has asthma or something, and I would have initial visit, and I would be sitting with the child half an hour and the parents. In the half an hour, the amount of times that the parents said no to the child, don't do this, don't do that, and the child paid no attention to them. And so after a while, I started actually counting. You know, I had like a little piece of paper on my desk. And every time they said no, I would put a check just so I could say. And I got up to 23 times in half an hour once. And not once did the child ever listen. Like, don't touch his tool. So they touched my tool. And so why would a person do that to be so ineffective? And I think the first thing that gets the parents is, if I don't teach them right, they're going to be a savage and a homeless bum and a prostitute. And the second one is, if I don't get them to act properly, this nice doctor is going to think I'm an incompetent idiot. It's going to reflect on me. My friends are going to realize that I'm a hopeless bum at raising my child, because my child is like out of control. And so I'm going to try to manage their behavior before it gets to that stage so I don't look so bad. And I can tell you, there is a guaranteed outcome of thinking like that, which is your child will harass the crap out of you. Guarantee it. And if you tell them no 23 times in a half an hour, what you're doing is teaching them not to listen to you. I used to tell the parents, patients, you get one no a week, and you better make it a good one. Like, and if you say no, and if you don't need to use the one, don't use it. But if you say it, like, you know, don't throw up on your sister. Like, then really don't throw up on your sister. Like, throw up in the toilet. And if you don't do that, what you're teaching them is not to listen to you, which is what most children these days learn.
How does that begin? I mean, is it because so many children are inside most of the day, unfortunately, on devices most of the day, eating foods that perhaps they shouldn't be, and the parents are like out to lunch because they have to, for whatever reason, you know, work jobs. There can't be one parent at least, you know, focusing in. So, you know, we have this kind of imbalance happening right now in the nuclear family. So is it really the child is just like, there's so much energy within them that they are like these little cyclones and there is just no stopping them. And the best thing to do is to just like, give them that wooden fence around and let them work it out. Where does that come from? I don't have a lot of experience with the no, because I didn't create conditions to have to say no. I wonder, you know, because I have many friends who struggle with that constantly. I mean, even the kid is like, you know, 6 years old, like, I don't have to listen to you. I've heard that. And I'm like, oh, wow, I've never heard my daughter say that. And I've also just like never punished her.
I heard it all the time. I mean, it happens because of these things. Because the parent's attitude towards this child from the get-go is, I've got to teach you to be proper or you're going to be a savage. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is they're ineffective. And that comes from this, it's like a deep feeling of insecurity on the part of the parents that I know I don't know what I'm doing. You'd be a lot better off, as I did with eventually with my children. I would admit it. I don't know. Here's what I think we should eat. Here's what I'm going to make. Either or you don't eat it. And here's what I think we should do. What do you want to do? And if I'm not going to force them to do anything, and you end up showing them that you're going to listen and you care and you're on their side. And then they don't have to, because what I think is happening is they're teaching us to be better people, even at their own expense. And, you know, I saw this once with the worst autistic child I ever encountered in all my years. And I had a lot of them because I was like a school doctor for 3 different Waldorf schools and all this for 35 years. And I ended up thinking that everything a child does or anything anybody does really is a communication strategy to express what their needs are. That's one way to put it. So I imagine then, so you take this, you know, day-old baby and you inject them with poisons so that they don't get a sexually transmitted disease. Like, that's nuts, right? Now, I asked myself, if you were this child, if I was this child, how would I communicate to my parents that this is like crazy? You don't want to be doing this to me. And I could explain it to them, but you're a one day old. You don't even know how to talk, right? You could write them a letter, but you don't know how to write. So the only thing you have available is scream. And so you scream enough, and then they might think, if you're lucky, wow, that was a really stupid thing I just did. I'm not going to do that again. But most of the time, they don't get it. So at 2 months, they go and inject you with more poisons, and then you start screaming again, because what are you going to do? You have to communicate that this is crazy. They're just poisoning you and for no reason at all. And then they still don't get it. And then they do it again at 4 months. And then they do it at 6 months. And then you have to act goofy. And why are you acting goofy? Because you have to make their life miserable so they stop doing this to you. And then this goes on, and sometimes parents, they don't even get it. And they say, there's something wrong with my child, et cetera. And then he's 4 and he's still acting goofy and banging his head and throwing things and the whole bit. And I saw this child and I said to the parents, you know, the problem here, it's not he doesn't have a problem. He's trying to communicate to you to stop doing these shots and stop poisoning him and stop giving him these drugs and stop feeding him this and stop hating each other, because the parents hated each other. And what was so amazing is the child at that moment, he's like he stops, sits down next to the mother, looks at her, folds his arms as if to say, so are you going to listen to this guy? Like, it's not my problem. And as soon as I don't need to communicate to you that you got to figure this out better, right? And stop doing these stupid things, then I don't need to act goofy anymore. Because I'm acting goofy so you get it, because I love you and I don't want you to be that stupid and I don't want you to treat me like this anymore. And some parents get it and some don't. And they just drug their children, et cetera. And they blame it on the vaccines, et cetera, which it is partly the vaccines, right? Because then you have two problems. You have the communicating to your parents and you've been poisoned, right? So you got to deal with that too. But I, that was the only thing that I saw would work. Like, I'm going to make your life miserable until you figure out that there's a better way to do life.
Until you get on my side.
Until you get on my side. And then when I saw that, I could successfully treat children's health problems. Before that, it was just managing symptoms.
Yeah, so there's almost like this, say, unconscious and conscious resentment toward the parents.
They can't articulate it.
Right, they can't articulate it. And so it just comes out in that behavior. It's a resentment. And I mean, I've seen rage towards some of my friends from their own kids. And, you know, what you're saying checks out. And it isn't until some of them, you know, at some point, because of certain behaviors and certain health issues that arose after all of the multiple poisonings, they kind of woke up and said, I'm not doing this anymore. And some of them have even apologized to their children. And that apology energetically made a huge difference. I mean, they've called me and told me, like, everything's changed. Like, she's like, I feel connected to her now. That space I felt, or the distance that they thought was a response to the poison, was actually an unconscious distance they created because they didn't feel safe with their own parent.
I would tell parents to go in their bedroom at night if they're young, and if they're older, you can talk to them and apologize for what you did. And that you just didn't, you know, we all as parents did stuff we didn't know any better. I did stuff I didn't, luckily I never vaccinated my children or took them to a pediatrician, but we all did stuff we wish we didn't do, and I apologized. And then I would actually tell the children, even like a 3-month-old, like when the parents weren't there, they would be like alone with the child. And I would say to the child, look, why don't you let me talk to your parents and tell them to stop doing this? And you don't have to do it anymore. And I think that helped. I tell them to stop feeding you like this and poisoning you like this. You know, I got you now. I'll help you with this so you can you don't have to get yourself sick in order to communicate a message. I'll help with that. And that was in a part of my role as a doctor.
Yeah, an alliance.
Yeah, with the child.
Yeah, I've gone through a similar exercise with some of the women I've worked with who feel a lot of, maybe let's call it guilt or shame, which is like the most damaging thing we can feel about the way that they chose to birth the baby and some of the self-poisonings they did during the pregnancy and some of the interventions they elected to do during the birth, and later recognize how that impacted the baby. And so they've done that a similar exercise, you know, apologizing for not knowing any better, apologizing for reacting out of fear, which is why I think parents choose to poison their children, is because they're fearful of, like, the, you know, the boogeyman that they've been told to be fearful of, right? So that's been an incredibly healing exercise for them, you know, in their journey to get closer and build more intimacy with their children. Because I always think, like, if my daughter wants to hang out with me when she's a teenager and an adult, like, I did something okay. Like, that's my measure for, like, how well I did. And so I tried to do things to make sure, you know, what would I have wanted, right? Like, what would I have wanted from my mother to build that trust? And then I just try to do that thing. And getting on their side is the thing.
Yeah, getting on their side and say, you know, how does the world look to you? And then if you're interested. And I can tell you that you're right, the shame and guilt doesn't help. And we've all done things with our children that were not the greatest things to do, everybody. So you just, and I think the children are very forgiving of that. And you just say, that was the best I knew at the time, and let's go on.
In all your years of practice, and in, even in writing this book, if you were to reverse engineer maybe the mother's like specific trajectory, I'm so curious how the way a woman approaches her pregnancy and her birth impacts the nuclear family. And I know that the bigger picture here, as you say in the book, is how we school our society. And it's like that, you know, this idea that there's a secret we're trying to get an answer to if we engage with school. So for me, that's kind of the bigger, you know, umbrella of our collective consciousness, is this idea that school is going to help us unlock the secret. And then this kind of more individual track is like, how is approaching birth and the pregnancy, how does that impact the way in which a mother and the nuclear family form and connect afterward?
I don't know that I've ever thought about it. So all I can say is that a healthy woman in a healthy marriage, who, you know, with the man, the husband, the father, essentially, you know, providing a container for the family to live in, that the mother feels safe and protected and cared for. And then comes all the things that, you know, we do, like eating good food and being out in the sun and grounding to the earth and not poisoning yourself. I mean, it should be a birth, you know, with a friend at home that has no problems, and it just goes as it goes. And that's what I would expect. And I don't see any, I mean, that's what happened with us. You know, we didn't have any interventions or, and we never went to an obstetrician or had an ultrasound or a flu shot or any blood tests or anything. I mean, I'm a doctor, like, you know, I haven't had like a physical exam since 1984, or a blood test, or anybody telling me how I am. To me, that's the key. I can figure out perfectly well how I'm doing by how I'm doing. I don't need somebody to tell me by sticking their finger up my butt or listening to my breathing how my breathing is. I can like go for a walk and maybe go a little faster and see if I'm okay with that. And that's a skill that's being lost, right? So mothers tend to think, I don't know how I'm doing. I need to get a blood test, or I need to get an ultrasound, which are extremely harmful interventions, by the way. Nobody should have an ultrasound in pregnancy. I don't know, maybe there's some sort of indication, but I can't think of one.
Do you know what it does to the developing fetus?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a whole chapter on, there's all kind of stuff. I mean, it heats up the baby's environment in a way that's really awful. There are all kinds of studies. There's an appendix in the book on the negative effects of ultrasounds. It's in some ways worse than x-rays. So there's almost, I would say, no indication for doing an ultrasound in pregnancy. There's almost no indication for doing a blood test. There's no indication for doing any, you know, vaccines or anything ever, so certainly not in pregnancy. So the power comes from a woman saying, I've got this. Now, maybe she needs to talk to you or a friend, and you've been through this before, and I've seen other women and I've talked to them. So, you know, what do you think about what I'm going through here? Right. So that's fine. But ultimately, the more in control and sovereign the person is, I think the better chance they have of delivering the baby themselves with a friend to help. The friend being, you know, a midwife or somebody who's done this a few times. Like, I'm not saying that there's no, you know, like reason or benefit from somebody who's had some experience. And if we're really sick, it's helpful to talk to somebody who's had some experience with something, right? That's okay. But ultimately, it's about empowering yourself. And I think the father and the husband is a part of that, who makes this safe container that the woman can feel, you know, okay, I can, you know, I got this.
Yeah, I'm always curious. I mean, when I've seen kind of high intervention births, it seems that there's also high intervention newborn and pediatric care, if that's what you want to call it. And so I was always curious about that association. You know, if there was a disconnect from the birthing experience, it would make sense that there might be, you know, in that postpartum process. And just feels like one thing often leads to another in those situations.
Yeah, one intervention leads to the next intervention, leads to separation of the mother and the child, and then the all kinds of untoward events happen to the child, and then you've got a real problem on your hands.
And then we move into the world of schooling, right? Because it seems like there's this really soft, easy period of time before we start going into that reward and punishment world. And it's interesting because it's almost like when the child is interested in movement, that baby, like when the child shifts from like maybe that 5 month to 8 month period where they've ideally are crawling, moving, that's when we start, they're no longer an infant that, you know, we're coddling and nourishing. Now we're starting to like maybe punish and reward, control a little bit more, or it's more obvious. Let's say the control is more obvious. And then often put children into these like, you know, pre-K programs or daycares or different institutions, and, you know, with the intention of socializing them. And then it becomes this whole thing. And so for me, like that, the idea of schooling, this centralized schooling and, you know, this more centralized birthing is really what has the nuclear family under attack. And, you know, the individualism that one can develop, their identity, their interest is under attack with these two things. So how does a woman, maybe she's at this juncture now where she's at a crossroads of, you know, how do I do school? How do I do this? How can she start to, let's say, like decentralize herself, unlearn this, you know, bit by bit? Because I know a lot of women say, yeah, I'm fine, you know, kind of just letting them be until they're like five, but then they need to go to school, because how will they have opportunities, and how will they have money, and how will they ever develop a skill, and how, you know? And I know this is a much, much bigger conversation, but that's the underlying fear for even the most, you know, let's say like alternative mothers, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, conscious parenting mothers.
Yeah, it goes back to the, if I don't teach them right and send them to school, they're going to be savages and homeless and a prostitute and end up snorting cocaine on the street. And so I've got to send them to this government-run, state-run institution that, you know, when you follow the whole thing back. So first of all, how does this state-run institution get its money to do these schools? And I typically ask people, have you ever gone over to your neighbor's house and said, you know, I saw you just put an addition on your house, and I'd like you to give me $1,000 a month so that I can send my child to school. And by the way, if you don't do it, I'm going to put you in a cage. I mean, people wouldn't do that. Or how about, if you don't do it, I got 20 friends, and we're going to come to your house, and we're going to, you don't fork over $1,000 a month, we're going to, or a year, we're going to put you in a cage. Nobody would do that. And yet everybody does that, because that's what the government does. You built an addition, we're going to steal your money, and we're going to call it a law or a tax, and then we're going to build a school. And then you have to go to the school, because if you don't go to the school, you're going to end up being a savage and a prostitute, and that, we can't have that. And Then we're going to, in first grade, we're going to teach you tolerance, right? Because tolerance, everybody wants to be tolerant and be, you know, get along with people of different races and colors. And so you have to be tolerant. And so you have to go to school and learn tolerance. Now, if you misbehave in tolerance class, we obviously cannot tolerate that. So we're going to give you drugs so you act better, because no good school can tolerate a child not doing well in tolerance class. And that's basically the whole thing. You have to do what we say in order, when we say it, every half an hour, you have to change what you're going to do. And you're going to do this for 12 years. Otherwise, you're going to be a savage. And if you don't do it, or you rebel, or you think, well, I don't like doing that stuff, we're going to do something nasty to you, because that's how we teach you to be free. When you think about that, that is crazy. And that's why these schools easily lapse into authoritarianism. You have to wear masks, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to take these tests, you have to sit quietly, even though they never do. And if you don't do it, we're going to drug you. It's inevitable. And, you know, the whole idea, they go on about, well, you do well in school and you go to college and then you get a good job. And those are the winners. So the head of the education department says, everybody has to go to college. The irony is, if you actually look at the percentage of college openings for 18-year-olds in any given year, it's about 46% of the 18-year-olds. So basically, that means 54%, there's no college they could go to. So those are the losers, right? So we set up this whole system of winners and losers. And if you don't do what you're told and behave and learn what you're supposed to learn when you're supposed to learn it, then you're a loser. And that's what, as I say to people, the only thing anybody learns in school is how to be schooled.
Yeah, and this is the fear that so many parents that I know are dealing with. It's like, my child can't be a loser, so I have to participate in this enslavement. And I think many women or parents, let's say, just don't know how to operate outside of the enslavement, right? Apart from creating their own commune or like micro society somewhere, like, how do you participate in the world if you're not playing that game?
Yeah. But, you know, parents used to come to me all the time. My child doesn't know how to read or is late learning to read. By the way, my child, when she started fifth grade, she couldn't read Run, Spot, Run. And the teacher called me up. She was in a Waldorf school, which I thought at the time were okay, which I've more or less changed my opinion.
Since
a lot of things, but COVID in particular. And he said, what do you think I should do about, you know, he was like a friend of mine. I said, the only thing I want you to do is don't let anybody tease her or try to shame her because she doesn't know how to read. Just that. You don't have to teach her how to read. Just don't make her feel bad. Just go on, because she could do a lot of other things really well. Turns out then she decides she wants to learn to read. 2 months later, she read Mists of Avalon, which it turns out wasn't such a good book to read. I didn't read it at the time. I had given it to her, and I could see afterwards she was going into puberty why she was interested in that book. But I didn't read it, so I didn't know that. But parents used to come, Johnny can't read. And I would say, okay, what I want you to do is do whatever you can to not teach this child to read. And then see if by the time they're 15, whether they don't know how to read. Don't try to teach them. Don't do anything. Just leave them alone. Now, if they ask you, like, what is this word, S-U-N, you say sun. You don't say, you don't go into this long thing about teaching them that S is pronounced S like that, or you just say sun. That's the answer. And I can guarantee you, you will not be able to prevent them from reading. And I was 100% right. Any child, there. So I ended up with coming to the conclusion that any sort of normally intelligent person, child, right, who hasn't been like, quote, brain damaged, you know, from vaccines or there's only really one reason why they can't, why they don't learn to read. And that's because you try to teach them when they're not interested. There is no other reason. So if you stop trying to teach them, they will say, and a guy named Ivan Illich proved this, he could teach illiterate peasants to read in 6 weeks fluently in Guatemala and other places. The only rule he had was you had to teach them to read the contract they had with their landlord who was trying to screw them out of their money.
Right. The motivation was there.
And so he's taught them how to read the contract. In 6 weeks, they could read anything. The problem is, if you say to a child at, say, 7 or 8, here, you have to read this boring, irrelevant thing about Johnny climbing, you know, a teeter-totter, and he's just not interested because he'd rather go outside and catch frogs or whatever, he will respond by stopping learning to read. It's the same as the food. If you try to force them to eat broccoli, they will respond by refusing to eat it. If you get out of it and say, I don't care, if you're interested in knowing what it says on this page or that page, just ask and I'll tell you.
Oh my gosh. I made that mistake during the pandemic. I remember that was when I pulled her out of the Waldorf school because they went totally woke. And she had shown interest. My daughter had shown interest because she was like kind of, she would open books and she'd start like, you know, kind of read, making sounds. And, you know, she was 4. She was like, oh, yeah. And la, 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 you know, making these sounds and looking at the words. And she loved animals. She still does. She dissects them. She saves them, you know, not live. You know, if she's she finds them dead, she, she's not torturing any animals, but she's really into it. And so she's always had biology books. It's her thing. So I said, oh, and I told a friend of mine who's an early childhood educator, and she said, get her this book, you know, and sit down with her. I sat down with her once to do a quote reading lesson, and she for 2 years refused to touch a pencil. Like the exercise was just tracing words and then sounding them out as you did it, and as soon as I did that, it was like absolute resistance, like as if I was like making her drink like coffee or something. Like she just was like no. Until one day she decided she wanted to learn more about animals and I wasn't available to read to her. So her motivation and interest came from wanting to learn about the animals without my being there. But it took 2 years to recover from that incident.
Yeah. And here's the thing. When you watch children interact together, they don't do that teaching thing. If they do, they get ostracized. And so here's the way that a child learns math. And I talk about this also in the book. You get this child who wants to build tree houses, right? 8-year-old boy, for instance. He's building tree houses. He's cutting the wood. He's putting it up there. And he's trying to figure out how to make it all line up and work. And you happen to have a friend who really knows how to build really good tree houses, right? So, and you say, you know, someday the child says, yeah, I really want to build these tree houses. You say, okay, I have this friend and he can probably help you with the tree house. So you take him over to his friend, maybe with some of his other friends. And the guy says, okay, so the first thing you have to do is you have to measure the sides and then you have to add up the sides so that we know how long to cut the boards, right? Because that's how you build a tree house. And the 8-year-old says, what's adding? because he doesn't know what that is. And the guy building the treehouse says, you're 8? You don't know what adding is? No, nobody ever told me about adding. Well, I can't teach you how to build a treehouse that you want to build until you know how to add numbers. Okay, so that's the end of it. That's the end of it. So the child comes home, and I can guarantee he says to his parents, somebody teach me how to add right now, or I'm going to find somebody who will. And so you say, okay, so here you go. You know, 2 + 2 is how it works. In 2 weeks, he'll be fluent in arithmetic. And then he goes back to the guy and says, did you learn? Yeah, I learned how to add. So now I know how to add these numbers. And so this, is there anything else I need to know? Yeah, you need to multiply, but we can start doing this like this. And then he builds a treehouse, and then he figures out he needs to build the roof. He needs to multiply, and then he needs to figure out how to angles and geometry, and because he wants to build a really better one. And you're not saying, oh, you need to learn how to do geometry when right now, because that's how you not be a savage and end up homeless. He says to you, I need to know how to do geometry to build the house that I'm thinking. I know I got it in my mind that I want to do this, but there's some details here that I don't know about. And I need somebody to teach me. And if you're not going to do it, I'm going to find somebody who will. And to me, that kind of classroom, which is not school, it's the class of life, right? Goes on for your whole life. I want to know how to read Dostoevsky. So you find somebody who has read it and learned it, and you go to them and say, what do you think about this? And there's maybe 4 other people, and you talk about it, and then you figure it out. And, you know, Ivan Illich set up this whole way of thinking about it, which is an educational society, which is a whole different thing than a schooled society. Schooled societies, he said, always go bankrupt. And they always promote, you know, really rich people, and most of the people are losers, and everybody hates each other, and everybody, the taxes go up because you got to build more buildings, and you got to get policemen for the buildings because everybody's shooting each other because they hate being there, and on and on and on. And that's what we got.
Yeah. It's one Band-Aid solution after another until we're just made up of a bunch of topical Band-Aid solutions.
Right. So, but the other, you know, there are practical things. You know, I tell parents, if you're the only person in your town who's not doing school, you got a problem. But if there's 100 other families, you got it made, because then you just figure out what your child wants to learn. And you find out other families whose children want to learn that. You hire somebody to teach them whatever it is, arithmetic, something. You know, and it's like, you know, it's the equivalent of if you had 10 boys who wanted to learn to shoot a basketball, and then you got Steph Curry to come and do a class on it, I can guarantee you nobody would act out or misbehave. Because if they did, one of the other boys would say, you leave, because you're messing with my ability to learn from this guy, and I don't want that. So you're out of here. Nobody misbehaves in that situation.
They're all interested and invested in being there.
Yeah, they want to be there, and they don't want to have, they're appreciative that this guy came and he's going to, you know, spend an hour showing them something that they want to know. And that's such the opposite of what happens in school. And I tell you, if you don't believe me, go and hang out a day in a public school or, you know, most private schools. It is a nightmare. One threat after another.
I mean, I've heard, even my own daughter, she spent one semester in a school, and oh my gosh, I like still am processing my own trauma from like witnessing that in her. But I gave it a shot, and it was not the Waldorf school. It's a different school, and Montessori based, let's just call whatever they wanted to call it. And I remember one day she came home, she's staring out the window. We were in the car. She's staring out the window, and I said, how's it going? I said, did anything, you know, silly happen? I just asked her specific questions. I said, did anyone get in trouble? Did anything silly happen? And she said, do you ever feel like you're just floating above your body? And I said, inside, you know, and my internal dialogue was like, oh my God, my daughter is like disassociating and we have a problem. And I just looked at her in the mirror and I said, yeah, it happens when I'm somewhere I don't want to be. And so I just, my whole life is focused around being where I want to be all the time so that I never have to do that. And she said, well, it happens to me every day. And I said, okay. And we just like never went back there. And, you know, after that point, you know, I finally asked her, you know, what, do you want to tell me like what was going on? Because I just pulled her out. I didn't ask any questions. I just was like, I'm always on her side for sure. As much as I can be at any given moment, as I learn more about this process. And she just said, I had to ask permission to use the bathroom. She's like, and sometimes they didn't believe me that I had to use the bathroom. I was like, you know, and of course I'm like crawling out of my skin. I'm like, wait, this is happening to you? And she said, yeah, you know, but I knew that, you know, you were working on a big project and you thought it was a great place for me. So I just didn't say anything. I'm like, oh my God, now my child's caretaking me. Like, what's going on here? You know? And that was the end of it. It was just never again. But as she recounted her experience, you know, having to ask permission to use her body when she needed to, she said, you know, the lights would start to hurt her eyes. So she'd just close her eyes. And the teacher would say, why are you sleeping? She said, I'm not sleeping. You know, she'd have her eyes closed. I'm not sleeping. I just can't with these fluorescents anymore. You know, she'd say, and I'm like, of course this would happen. You know, she's been outside her whole childhood. I've never asked this of her. And in a sense, it was almost like experimental. And I'd never heard her use the word bored before. And she said, Mom, I would feel bored. And it was almost like, she said nothingness is how she described it. I said, this must be how all children feel.
That is how they feel. And the compliant ones just deal with it. And the rebellious ones try to get out somehow, get kicked out, misbehave, throw things, bash people, whatever. Any strategy they can think of.
I was in and out of the principal's office my whole school experience. I mean, I was...
It's like prison.
At the Jewish day school.
Prison with athletic facilities. That's what college is.
That's right. And access to other things that make you think you're free. But yeah, so it's a prison break. And so to speak, you know, the unlearning that goes in, you know, as an adult, right, as you're coming into this, it's that unlearning process and making, reconciling how we grew up, you know, and saying, okay, like, that's what it was. And thank you. And like, how can I now alchemize that through this little person's journey that I'm shepherding, you know? And then you just do the best that you can.
Yeah, well, your daughter's lucky to have you. I can tell you that.
Thank you. Thank you. So, yeah, Tom, this has been an incredible conversation. I loved your book. I actually read most of it with my daughter, and she was fascinated because she said, he's on to something. She said, I can tell you, nobody wants to be there. She says, I know, she said it yesterday, actually, because there was one part that we were reading in the schooling, the second part of the book. And she just said, I remember kids were only doing things because they didn't want to get in trouble. Kids were only doing things because they wanted their parents to love them. I mean, that's what it is, right? We have all this languaging for it. Like, as adults, we have all this languaging for it. But coming from a 9-year-old, it's so simple. Kids are only participating in school because they don't want to get punished or they want their parents to love them, because children are loyal. They will take on a lot for us so that we can like do whatever it is we think we're doing.
Absolutely. That's it in a nutshell. You know, and there's my favorite quote about school from Ivan Illich, who everybody should read, is school is the process where if you do well in school, you get the dubious privilege of being able to consume more school until you've consumed so much school that the only people you can talk to are people who've consumed a similar amount and type of school. And that's like virologists and economists and political scientists and geographers. They've consumed so much school, and it's mostly nonsense. And only people left they can talk to are similar school people.
Yeah, unless they've done the prison break themselves, you know, like exited stage left. But you mentioned that too in the book with PhDs, right? Or it's like you get to that point and then you hit the ceiling, and what can you only talk to other people who've like specialized in that school, like who've done the same amount of school, you know? It's wild. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for this gift you've given us, this book. I'm going to put it in the show notes, a link to it, Common Sense Child Rearing. It made a big impression on us, and I'm just so grateful for it and so grateful for everything you do and everything you've done for families. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks, Isla.